From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. Now, we all know the holidays are one of the busiest travel times of the year, and if you're out on the road at night, have you felt as if you're being blinded by the light, by super bright LED or high-intensity discharge headlights? They're great for illuminating the road in front of a driver, but not so great for oncoming drivers. And as the lights get more powerful and drivers get older, well, I am here to tell you it's not just you. It's time to start talking about equipment standards dating back to the 60s and the modern dangers of headlight pollution on American roads. So this hour on Point, bright, even blinding headlights, and how to make sure everyone can see clearly on the road. And you can join us. Have you been dazzled or distracted by brighter lights on American roads? Do you like driving with bright LEDs, HIDs in your headlights? And what's your take on advanced lighting systems and how they can make driving better for all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And I also should say that a little later this hour, we're going to have a great conversation about a completely different kind of light, the light that you see from the moon cast by planet Earth. We'll be talking with Apollo 8 astronaut Bill Anders a little later this hour. But first, let's start with this conversation about super bright headlights on American roads. And joining us from Latham, New York, is John Bullough. He's Director of Transportation and Safety Lighting Programs at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and he's conducted research on nighttime driving and the crash risk of glare for the Federal Highway Administration. John Bullough, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you, and thanks for joining us on Christmas Eve as well, I should say. The genesis of this conversation for us at the program was one of our producers brought the idea to the table, and at first, you know, there was kind of like a, why should we be talking about this now? And then everyone kind of at the sudden said, but this is a real thing. It feels like as if in the past 5 or 10 years, headlights have been getting so much brighter on cars at night. So is this anecdotal, or have they?
Well, it's the same question when I tell people I work at a place called the Lighting Research Center. Half the time, that's the first question that I hear is, can you do something about those headlights? So I do think there are some things that have been going on with headlight technology that have made that problem much more obvious to people.
Yeah. You know what made it obvious to me? And again, I there are limits to anecdotal evidence. But a couple of years ago, I started finding myself squinting a lot when I'd be driving at night and there'd be oncoming headlights. And I thought, okay, I mean, I'm not in my 20s anymore, but I'm also not in my 60s or even my 50s. So what's going on there? And then thereafter, not long after that, I was fortunate enough to take a European vacation. And I noticed that I was never squinting with super bright headlights or very infrequently in Europe. So is there a difference between what's sold in the United States and what's sold in Europe?
There are some differences. There actually are probably a little bit more of these high-intensity discharge, or HID, sometimes called xenon headlights, as well as light-emitting diodes in other parts of the world, especially in Europe and then in the United States. But like you said, those systems are different in some ways. There are limits in the regulations outside of the United States that require a headlight that produces a lot of lumens or a lot of light output to have automatic leveling systems and to have little washing systems. So sometimes these are actually little water sprays or even little mini windshield wipers on the headlight lens to help reduce glare for oncoming drivers.
Okay.
We don't have those in the United States.
All right, so we'll talk more about that in a minute, because that's a really interesting difference here. But first of all, so tell us, with these LEDs that came on the market years ago and these high-intensity discharge lamps that we're talking about as well, how much brighter are they actually than, you know, the older halogens that we all grew up with?
Well, it depends on how you define brighter. In terms of the maximum intensity or the peak brightness, the headlights are all pretty much the same whether they're using a halogen lamp, which is the sort of incandescent filament that we were used to, or a xenon or an LED. But because these light sources like xenon and LED are more efficient, they produce more lumens for the same number of watts. And so sometimes you find a 35-watt HID headlight produces about twice as much light as a 55-watt halogen headlight, which is on many of our cars now. That light won't necessarily get put right down the middle of the road because the headlight requirements are the same no matter what kind of lamp you have. That extra light gets spread out in more peripheral areas, and we tend to notice that a lot more driving on curves or especially hills.
Okay, so explain this a little bit more to me. So like LEDs, one of the great things about them, as you mentioned, is that they put out a lot of light for less power. But but is the problem what you're saying, that because that light is scattered across a broader area, that it's distracting or affecting oncoming drivers more? I'm still not quite seeing why it feels like things are so much brighter and harder to see at night.
Well, there's probably a couple of reasons. One of those has to do with the aim of the headlights, and that's a problem that's been going on for a number of decades in terms of just the general deterioration in how well or poorly our headlights are aimed, moving towards poorly. But also the color of the light. You'll notice that many of those headlights, the newer headlights, look a little bit more blue or cool white compared to the warmer white of the halogen lamps. And that also has an impact on how we see. Even if the light meter says it's the same number of candelas in terms of intensity, our eyes are going to say that those bluer lights look brighter, and that's going to cause more discomfort and more annoyance.
Now, are we talking about lights that are both manufacturer installed for in new automobiles and as well the ones that, say, people just replace on their own?
Well, that's a whole other issue.
Okay.
But the color of the light usually is bluer for those newer headlights. And the ones that are designed for the vehicle in general work pretty well as long as they're aimed properly. But that is a problem. Many states don't have aim measurements as part of the inspection process, including New York State, where I live. And we also find that the color of the light is a problem. But those replacement bulbs are definitely bad news in terms of giving you a good beam pattern if the lamp wasn't made for that car.
Right. Well, you know, this has really touched a nerve with listeners. We're getting so many comments here. On Twitter, someone calling themselves The Real RFC says, "I hate bright headlights. LED lamps are the worst. I avoid driving at night whenever I can because I literally cannot see to drive safely and feel constantly blinded. This invariably leads to frustration, anger, and rage." And then on the website, Rick Evans says, "Most suburban and urban roads are already illuminated to a point where you hardly need your headlights. I'm often blinded by oncoming halogens, especially in rural areas. Oncoming headlights reduce your night vision for quite a few seconds." So, John Bulla, I mean, have we reached the point where, I mean, is this a safety concern?
Well, that's something that we've been looking at in some of our studies is that we know on the Department of Transportation website, they take public comments, and there have been thousands of comments on headlight glare, which usually they may get dozens or possibly hundreds on issues like tires and seatbelts and things like that. So it's definitely an issue that people are in touch with and notice when they're driving. And the federal government is obviously very concerned when they get that many comments that they're you know, wanting to find out why these comments are coming in. So they are very concerned about glare and looking at what the regulations may have to change. And some of that is beginning to happen in the regulation world.
Okay. Well, John, stand by here for a second because I want to bring in Mark Phelan. He's just joining us from Detroit. He's an auto critic and columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Mark Phelan, welcome to you.
Nice to be here.
And happy Christmas Eve as well. Thanks for your time. Do you share On Point listeners' frustration and anger when it comes to these really newly bright LEDs and headlamps that are all over America's roads?
No, honestly, I think they're a great thing for safety. I think that the most important thing by far is that they be aimed correctly. Dr. Bulla, you could not have been more right about that and about the need to keep the lenses clean so that they are the lights directed properly. But the problem is more that because it looks white, it seems different to people, and people's eyes are drawn to it more than just the old yellowy bulbs that we're used to. These days, I test a lot of new vehicles, many of which have these lights. These days, when I get back into a vehicle that's got the older incandescent light, I'm amazed that I was ever able to drive that way.
Oh,
the difference is night and day, almost literally.
Right. So in terms of being the driver in a vehicle that has the brighter lights, it's far superior because you can see more.
Yes.
Yeah. But you know, you were saying it just a second ago that that for oncoming drivers, when their eyes are more prone to look at the lights because they're whiter. I mean, are you suggesting we can train ourselves out of that or what?
I suspect so. I think, as you know, you mentioned, it's more common to have lights like this in Europe, and people just get used to them. It's just like when you're learning to drive, one of the things the instructor tells you is don't look into the headlights of the car coming toward you. The same principle applies. It's just that because these lights look different, we're tempted to glance over at them more, I think. That's a perceptual issue, and I don't have any data behind it, but that's what it feels like when I'm on the road. But again, aiming is incredibly important, and there are new technologies being developed that can make the headlights adaptive and responsive in ways that will improve aiming even further.
Yeah.
And that's very important.
Well, Mark, I'm glad you said that, because quite frankly, I'm skeptical about your "we can train ourselves out of this" theory. John Bulla, respond to what Mark's saying. Talk to me more about aiming. If I'm you know, just going to replace my own headlamps, how do I know how to aim it properly?
Well, it is something that's difficult to do at home. Depending on the type of headlight, you may be able to shine your lights as long as you have a flat surface and a wall that you can aim those lights on, and some distance, at least 25 feet, but preferably more. You'll notice most low beam headlights have a very sharp cutoff. They'll be sort of almost like a horizontal line you paint on the wall. Below that line is a lot of light, and above that line should be very little light. And depending on the type of headlight, you can adjust, and there's usually a little screw set inside the headlight that you can adjust that aiming point up or down to get it to the proper height. It depends on the height of your headlights and a lot of things. Generally, it's something that can be done at the auto shop as opposed to doing it at home to make sure it's done properly.
But the glory of being able to just do simple auto repair at home, though, I'm never going to let go of that here. John Bulla, stand by, and Mark Phelan, stand by as well. We are talking about those super bright headlights that seem to be everywhere on American roads these days, and whether or not they're too bright, or perhaps is it causing a danger on American roads, and what can be done about it. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And as we're in the midst of the holidays and travel season, we're talking about really bright car and truck headlights on American roads and the fact that they're getting brighter or seem to be getting brighter. And is this the time to talk about light pollution on American roads? John Bulla joins us. He's Director of Transportation and Safety Lighting Programs at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. He's done research on nighttime driving and the crash risk of glare for the Federal Highway Administration. Mark Phelan is also with us. He's an auto critic and columnist for the Detroit Free Press. And John and Mark, you will not be surprised to hear that a lot of people have something they want to say about these car headlights. So let me turn to a bunch of callers. Michael is calling from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A couple points about this. I am a truck driver with over 3 million miles behind me, and I can attest that it has been getting worse and worse. A couple of points about it is the misalignment of these lights. In Massachusetts, we do have a headlight aiming regulation as part of the safety inspection. And I know in a lot of other states they don't, but I can tell you that in Massachusetts, the problem is as bad as it is anywhere else. I would like to see more enforcement. Hard to believe a truck driver would be saying that, but I would like to see more enforcement about these things, about the use of high beams in general.
Yeah.
And also the aspect of driving lights, lights mounted low under the bumper.
Uh-huh.
All of a sudden, a few years ago, everybody discovered them. They're out there, and they don't seem to be align very well.
Right. Well, Michael, I'm going to take your call here, and thank you so much for giving us a ring. John Bulla, I'm interested in Michael saying, pointing out that, yes, there are state-level regulations as well, let alone what federal regulations on car lamps might be. But he's saying that they're perhaps not even enforced well enough in his home state of Massachusetts with those annual car inspections. So your thoughts on that?
Well, that may be true. Part of the issue with the regulations is that the headlight standards are developed by the federal government, and then the alignment of the headlight itself is generally through each different state that has their own method of doing that. And as the caller mentioned, some states will require that as part of the safety inspection, and some won't. The sort of margin of error that you have within the safety inspection is about 4 inches at 25 feet. Which is, you know, almost a degree and a half of angle, which sounds like a pretty small angle. But when you're talking about lighting something that's a few hundred feet ahead, 3/4 of a degree up or down can make a huge difference in the amount of light that's either going to hit the road where we want it to see hazards, or possibly hit the eyes of other drivers.
Right. Well, let's go.
If I could add to
that. Yeah, go ahead, Mark. Sure.
Headlights are a safety critical feature. It's easy to take them lightly because we think we replace light bulbs at home all the time. But they're critical to your safety, and you really should be very careful about who replaces them, how it's fixed, just like you would if you were getting your brakes redone.
Well, on that point, though, I mean, we just hopped on YouTube to see, like, what could we find if we wanted to just – if we weren't, you know, a trained auto mechanic and we wanted to just replace our own headlamps. I mean, millions of people must have this exact need all the time. And here's – just out of a quick search, here's what we found, a video teaching viewers how to put LED headlights into a Honda Accord.
The bulbs just pop out. Look at that. That's how simple it is, guys. It's nothing hard, nothing too difficult, and everyone can do it, guys. And a lot of people ask me, what are some mods that you can do to your car that make you look extremely nice? However, I don't want to put too much effort into it. And lighting is definitely the way to go, guys. Everyone sees your lights, especially at night. It just looks amazing.
Mark Phelan, what do you think? I mean, that guy's just saying, just pop him in. It's fine.
Well, I've got a friend who actually doubled the size of his house with videos he learned from YouTube, so I don't want to dismiss them completely. But I would be careful about somebody who's that enthusiastic about everybody's going to see your lights from miles away. That may not be exactly what you want.
Well, and to your point that they're safety critical, right? So it's, you know, it's something more than just popping them in. And you know, people can do very, very high quality work at home. I completely agree, but maybe it's a little harder than just popping things in and out. Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Eugene, Oregon. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm 70 years old, and I had my cataracts dealt with a couple of years ago, and I can see a lot better. Well, I play in a couple of rock bands, and when we're driving home at night, we drive home late at night often, and I can tell you that these bright blue headlights are just plain dangerous. Now, I will say that some of the new cars that are out there with the bright lights, they're not so bad. But the real offenders here are the people that go out and take a Honda Civic and, you know, trick it out with these lights. And just like your other callers have said, they install them, they don't aim them properly, and they're bad. But the worst offenders are these guys in these tall trucks. Okay, the truck is tall enough as it is, and then they lift them up, put these bright lights in them, and then, to make matters worse, they like to tow a trailer behind them. And so they just don't bother to deal with their headlights, and they basically just blind you.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thank you for your call. John Bulla, let me turn back to you. I mean, look, it's a great American right to drive just about whatever kind of automobile you want, and I'm not going to quibble with that. But are we perhaps also dealing with federal regulation on headlamp standards, vehicle standards, that hasn't necessarily kept up with where the technology for the illumination is right now?
Well, I would say in some ways the technology, especially the replaceable bulbs, the ones that you can get aftermarket, for example, like on the YouTube video we just heard, we've done some tests on a number of those types of products that you can buy on the internet. And they'll easily fit into the sockets, and you'll turn on your headlights and the road right in front of your car will look very nice and bright. But we found that about two thirds or three quarters of the time, those bulbs are not producing headlight beams that are at all useful for driving, for seeing anything more than 30 feet in front of your car, and they produce a lot of glare. So when you shine the beam pattern up on the wall, you just see a blob of light. And those can be very, very dangerous, and they're illegal. Even some of these products that we've tested that may have a DOT stamp, which says it's supposed to meet the regulations when it's put in a headlamp bulb, almost always don't meet that requirement. The other point the caller made was about the headlamp height, and that is something that as we have more SUVs, more pickup trucks, that those headlight regulations are generally, if you draw a straight arrow out from the headlight, you're gonna aim everything to that point. When you move those headlights up higher off the ground, they're just bringing up the point at which more light can reach in the eyes of other drivers.
Mm.
So aftermarket products generally are a big disaster, in my opinion, that if the headlight was designed for a specific bulb, that's the type of bulb that it needs to be replaced with.
Right. Well, Mark Phelan, let me turn to you, because you were talking about you're the auto critic for the Detroit Free Press, and I'd love to hear from you if there's the possibility that new cars, as they roll off the line in this year or in coming years, may have technology in them that makes this problem kind of go away, right? Because I'm reading that in other countries, there's already cars on the road that have adaptive headlights that automatically change the angle of their beam depending on if cars are coming at them. Do I have that right?
That's very close. And some of these are on sale in Europe already. They're being tested here. The Department of Transportation Safety regulators are very cautious about making any big change in something that is basic to the safety of a vehicle. So it takes a while to go through it, and that's frustrating to the lamp manufacturers and the car companies, frankly. But one of the things that they're doing is basically just having little shades that drop down in front of part of the bulb. There's a sensor that sees where is the oncoming vehicle, and a shade will drop down so that the light is still going out full distance all around the vehicle, but the driver is not blinded. That's one of the things that's going on in Europe. Laser headlights, which if you... That could sound like a nightmare if you think they're already too bright. But those, they are extremely aimable. So that's another area that's going on. And just the fact of automatic high beams, which are becoming relatively common. When those were first in use, they weren't tuned all that well. So sometimes you'd find yourself blinding people. But as companies built more of them, they got better. And now I think that they're one of the most useful tools on the road.
Yeah. Well, look, let's go to more callers here, because again, this has really touched a nerve. So Owen is calling from Wauwega, Wisconsin. Owen, you're on the air.
Happy holidays. Thanks for taking my call. So I work on the road a lot. I do emergency roadside assistance for vehicles that are down, mostly for commercial vehicles. And so I'm out there at night quite often. And one of the biggest risks and problems I see right now is that when I come up on a wreck or a truck that's down that already has law enforcement on site, I have a hard time, and I'm only 40 years old and I have good vision. I don't wear glasses or anything. I have a hard time determining what side of the road the emergency vehicle that has the light beacons on top is actually on. And I have to go real slow approaching that to find out exactly where that cruiser is and to find the truck I need to work on.
Owen, let me just jump in here for a second, because you're bringing up a really interesting point. So Owen's talking about obviously the lights on top of a police or state trooper's vehicles being really incredibly bright. And Owen, I just wanted to jump in here because several years ago, we're based in Massachusetts, there was a spate of terrible deaths. State troopers died on the sides of roads here in Massachusetts. And there was a big investigation done. And one of the things that they determined, not the sole cause, but one of the causes, was exactly what you're talking about, that the LEDs on top of the troopers' vehicles, when they had pulled folks over on the side of the road, were so bright that drivers couldn't even see the state troopers who were, talking to the vehicle, who had gotten out of the car and talking to the vehicle in front of them. So it's a safety risk for all sorts of people, including the troopers and police officers themselves, Owen. I just wanted to throw that in there.
There's another portion of that, too. When I get out and I start doing a technical repair on that vehicle that I have to work on, and that strobe light is going behind me or in front of me, depending on what type of situation we're in, I have a hard time even making repairs because it disorients you and makes it hard for you to use your motor skills, your fine motor skills, to make repairs. And another thing that I wanted to point out, here in Wisconsin, we have a problem with winter precipitation and elements. Those newer LED headlights don't give off any type of heat like the older halogen lights or the 1157 bulbs did. And I find there's drivers out there that don't realize that they're diminishing their amount of lumens as they drive in any type of precipitation, and they don't get out
right.
their lights.
Because of all the snow and ice on the lamps themselves. Well, Owen, thank you so much for your call. Let's see if we can get at least a couple more in here. Kathy's calling from Harshaw, Wisconsin. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. About 10 years ago, I took a job about 200 miles away, so I started driving a lot early in the morning and at night. And I noticed the headlights were really bothering me, and my vision started to decrease. I asked eye doctors about it, because when you go into a store to buy bulbs for your household, they always tell you on the LED labels and on the halogen labels not to look directly into the bulb. That always bothered me, and that we were converting our headlights to those. And it seemed to go hand in hand. My vision, my decrease in vision, went hand in hand with driving at night and being exposed to that. No eye doctor could really answer that for me.
Oh, interesting. So,
but I've been asking that question for at least the last 10 years.
Well, so. Kathy, thank you for your call. Let me turn your question to John Bullo. Are these lights doing anything to our eyes if we're looking at them all night long?
Well, they're probably not. In terms of the maximum brightness is again not necessarily any different than the halogen lamps.
Okay.
But obviously, as we do age, we do find that there's more stuff floating around inside our eyes that's going to scatter light. So glare can become more of a problem as we get older. But it's probably not. There's not something inherently dangerous about LED or xenon technology compared to halogen. All of those can be pretty bright. A filament is a pretty bright light source as well.
Okay, well, let's sneak one more in here. Randy is calling from Ripon, Wisconsin. Randy, did I say that right, or is it Ripon, Wisconsin?
It's Ripon.
Ripon, okay.
Thank you for taking my call.
All right.
You know, for years, these blue headlights, what comes to mind with me is I was always told never to look into an arc welder's bright blue light because it'll cause eye damage. And for years, I put my hand through my eyes because it physically hurts my eyes. I'm 62 years old, and it seems to me like it's a lawsuit just waiting to happen. So I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Well, Randy, thank you so much for your call. Mark Phelan, what do you want to respond to, Randy?
I haven't seen any research that shows a relationship between, you know, these kinds of lights and accidents. So I wouldn't be surprised if somebody has tried that lawsuit, but how it turned out is a mystery to me if somebody did.
Yeah. Well, so just to circle back to something we were talking about a minute or two ago, Mark, when we were mentioning the auto-aiming technology that we're seeing in some cars in Europe now and whether or not that's going to come to the United States, I'm seeing reporting here that one of the obstacles to that might be our own current standard, right? Like Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard number 108. That's the equipment standard dating back to the 60s, which regulates how much light and where they must be located on vehicles. And that maybe that has to be changed before we can get new technology that auto aims itself.
That could be part of it. And part of it also is that regulators are incredibly reluctant to design something that's got moving parts if they're not sure that the fail-safe, if the moving parts cease to move, is something that will not cause any harm.
Right.
So, you know, that's one extra regulatory hurdle that I think has to be cleared in the U.S. compared to in most of Europe. So I think they're, you know, waiting, you know, for a sort of a belt and a suspenders answer to that question.
Well, John Bullo, we've just got a little over a minute left here to go. I'm wondering, what's your sort of recommendation for drivers, you know, maybe those who are looking to replace their lamps and the rest of us who are also facing those lights coming on every night. What should people do if indeed this is such a challenge?
Well, I think, again, the aim of the headlights is really the probably the most critical factor that's going to help us see down the road, because if our lights are pointed down too far, we won't create glare for other people, but we won't be able to see. And if obviously if they're pointing up, we are going to create glare. So regularly checking our headlight aim when we bring it to the mechanic for an oil change is not a bad idea. Making sure the lenses on our headlights are clean. Those things are probably the best practical advice that someone can do on their own vehicle. Buying replacement bulbs and that sort of thing is definitely not the way to go.
All right. Well, John Bulla is Director of Transportation and Safety Lighting Programs at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Thank you so much for joining us today. And if you're driving at all over the holidays, John, I wish you safe driving.
Thank you, Meghna. You too.
And Mark Phelan, auto critic and columnist for the Detroit Free Press. Same to you. Thank you so very much for joining us, and safe driving over the holidays.
You're very welcome.
Listeners, keep your comments coming about this at onpointradio.org, but stick with us for now, because when we come back from the break, we're going to be talking with Bill Anders, an astronaut on Apollo 8, who 50 years ago today took one of the most famous pictures ever, or at least of the 20th century. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Now, let's talk about a different kind of light. A small sphere of luminous blue set against an unfathomable infinite black.
For all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you.
50 years ago today, Christmas Eve 1968, Apollo 8 astronaut Bill Anders, along with Jim Lovell and Frank Borman, the first humans ever to orbit the moon, looked back across the 250,000 miles between them and home and sent this message.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
That's Anders there reading from the book of Genesis. And on that same Christmas Eve, Bill Anders took a photo of the liquid blue light of planet Earth, rising above the bleak gray lunar surface. His Earthrise photo became one of the most influential photographs of the 20th century, showing all of humanity what the crew of Apollo 8 had witnessed. As Lovell said, quote, "The vast loneliness is awe-inspiring, and it makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth." Well, joining us now from San Diego, California, is Apollo 8 astronaut and retired Air Force Major General Bill Anders. Bill Anders, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
And thank you so very much for taking some time out of your Christmas Eve 2018 to speak with us. Mr. Anders, first of all, just take us back to December 1968, 50 years later. How do you look back upon your historic mission?
Well, it was a lot of firsts for Apollo 8. It was the first time that humans rode the mighty Saturn V rocket. It was the first time that humans left the gravity and broke free of the gravity of their own home planet. First time we went as far from Earth as the moon, and the first time people went into our nearest neighbor in the solar system, the moon. So there were lots of firsts on Apollo 8.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about moonshots, that was the first moonshot that humanity made, right? And so, you orbited the moon, what, 10 times on this mission. That first time that you went behind the moon and lost sight of home, lost sight of Earth, what was that like?
Well, as we were going backwards in our space vehicle to get into lunar orbit, we had to burn the rocket engine we had on our command and service module in order to slow down to be caught by lunar gravity. I can remember going, losing sight of the Earth and going into the moon shadow, and then going into the shadow from the moon of Earthshine. And the sky was just totally black background and absolutely full of so many stars you couldn't tell the constellations. But as I look back over my right shoulder, suddenly the stars stopped, and there was this black hole. And the hair came up kind of on the back of my head, and that was the black hole was the moon blocking out all light that we had coming either from the sun or from the Earth. Kind of scary.
I mean, no human had ever been so cut off from planet Earth as the three of you were then.
Well, that's right, and we had to make a very critical maneuver to burn our rocket engine for several minutes and to slow us down so that we could stay in a 60 by 160-mile orbit around the moon. We didn't want to hit it. And we didn't want to bounce out away from it. So this was a very critical maneuver that we had to do all by ourselves.
Right. I mean, in the multiple burns you had to do, you had the option of, like you said, hitting the lunar surface. Definitely didn't want to do that. Spinning out away from the moon and away from planet Earth. Also didn't want to do that. Orbiting the moon until your oxygen ran out. Definitely did not want to do that. Or getting it right. Now, of course, you guys got it right. Thank goodness here. But tell us the story of what happened when you came around, and was it the first time or on a subsequent orbit where you saw Earth return from behind the moon?
We didn't see the Earth for three orbits around the moon. We were going backwards, upside down. I remember coming around and getting radio contact with the Earth, and started discussing lunar craters, one of which I had named after myself for training. But we went around the moon three times and then reoriented the spacecraft so that we'd be going head down but pointy nose forward. And as Frank Borman made the attitude adjustment to do that, out of the corner of my eye, I caught a flash of color because the moon was really gray and beat up and, frankly, by that time, getting a little boring. It was one hole after the next. And suddenly there was this apparition. So I had a camera and snapped a picture of it. Borman jokingly says, hey, you can't do that. It's not on the flight plan because I had a heavy load of lunar craters to photograph.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Andrews, can I just jump in here for a second? Because
sure.
The moment you're referencing, we actually have the recording of that moment. It happened just after about 10:30 a.m. Houston time on December 24th, 1968, so almost exactly 50 years ago to this moment. And we have this tape here. You're going to hear Commander Frank Borman preparing a roll maneuver to reorient the spacecraft. And then we'll hear Bill Anders, we'll hear your reaction to what you saw. So here it is.
Oh, my God, look at that picture over there. There's the Earth coming up. Wow, is that pretty. Hey, don't take that. It's not scheduled. You got a color film, Jim? Hand me a roll of color quick.
Oh, man, that's
great.
Where is it?
Quick.
Bill, I got it framed. It's very clear right here.
Got it?
Yep.
Take several of them.
Take several of them. Here, give it to me.
Wait a minute. Let's get the right setting here. Just calm down, Mama.
Oh, I got it right. Oh, that's a beautiful shot.
That's Bill Anders, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman. I love that moment where, was that you, Mr. Anders, who's telling Jim Lovell, calm down, Lovell?
Right. He was getting pretty excited, but his windows were kind of fogged up. And I had the color film and the long lens, and so my window was about the clearest in the spacecraft. So the combination of clear window, long lens, and color is what actually captured what eventually became known as Earthrise.
Mm-hmm. So this is this photo that's so famous, so well known. In the foreground, you see the bleak, sort of blasted gray horizon of the moon, and then the darkness of space beyond, and that perfect, and that just the blue, the perfect blue of planet Earth in the distance. Seeing Earth like that from where you were, coming up over the moon's horizon, how did that change you, Bill Anders?
Well, at the time, we were so busy, I didn't really focus too much on the philosophical or political aspects of it. But as time went by, it became more impressive to me that as you looked at this beautiful, fragile orb that we live in, that you could see no boundaries, no political divisions, and also you could tell that it was quite small, I mean, physically insignificant, though yet that's the planet and the orb of which we evolved. And I always thought it was too bad that we couldn't get the United Nations up there to see this same view. Maybe we'd stop throwing bombs and rockets at each other and take better care of it.
Do you still feel that way?
Even more so. As time goes by, you know, maybe it's just getting old, but the poet in me sees that the Earthrise picture, which had helped, didn't start, but helped kickstart the environmental movement, which had kind of stalled out, brought understanding or greater understanding to people about the fragility of our planet. Has impressed me even more so. And indeed, I was impressed when the International Astronautical Union just recently dedicated a crater to the Earthrise event itself, which is in the field of view of the now iconic Earthrise photo called Anders Earthrise.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I want to take a quick call here, if I may. Let's go to Todd, who's calling from Springfield, Ohio. Todd, you're on the air with Bill Anders.
Yes, good day. I mean, what an amazing adventure. I couldn't even, there's so many questions, but how did the whole event, and you just touched on it some, affect you on a spiritual level? I mean, I can't imagine you not only just going through such a wild experience, but turning around and seeing that. How did that change your look at God?
Well, Todd, I don't want to get into a religious debate, but one thing, it's certainly clear that if you see the Earth that's about the size of your fist at arm's length, it doesn't take much of a mathematician to figure at 10 arm's length, the Earth would be about the size of a marble, and at 100 arm's length, it would be down to being about the size of a ladybug. You wouldn't have to, and those are distances that are hardly anywhere in space. So one thing that impressed me is that even though the Earth is physically insignificant, it certainly is important to humanity. But it also is very small, and it's not. It impressed me that we who go around a rather insignificant star called the Sun in a relatively insignificant galaxy, we're not the center of the universe, and you can take that, about any way you want to, but we definitely are out on the edge of almost nowhere in space.
Well, you know, that photo that you took that captured so perfectly the truth of our fragility in this universe, in 1968, it couldn't have come at a better time, right? I mean, 68 was such a tumultuous year for the United States at the very least, right, with the assassination of Dr. King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, just political upheaval left and right. I know that I think it was Commander Borman that received a four-word telegram after the Apollo 8 mission ended saying, "Thanks, you saved 1968. Did you get that sense? Maybe, you know, after splashing back down on Earth in the days and weeks and months that followed?
Well, we had been almost isolated by the political turmoil because of spending, you know, just almost continuous time in the simulators. But, of course, I knew of the trouble the country was going through. Indeed, I had a lot of friends over in Vietnam who were being shot up where I would be had it not been for my Apollo duties. But indeed, it was 68, even then, it was pretty clear it was about the only positive thing that was happening in the world.
It makes me wonder, I wish we could do something about 2018, to be quite frank.
might be more than Apollo to fix this one.
Yeah. Well, but on that note, we've just got a couple minutes here, Mr. Anders. This is the thing that always gives me hope about the U.S. space program, that troubled as it might be and costly as it might be, it still provides us with scientific knowledge, the ability to explore, and these moments, photographic or otherwise, that really bring us all together as people. So are you happy with where the U.S. space program is now, and where would you like to see it go?
Well, yes and no about happiness. I think the unmanned program, both from a practical point of view of weather satellites and communication satellites, many others, is moving right along. The scientific program, okay, Mars lander, rovers, the Chinese are putting a radio telescope on the back of the side of the moon. I think that's great. But the unmanned program, which is very expensive, but indeed catches the attention of humans more than unmanned spacecraft. It's so expensive, and yet has been a bit of a letdown. The shuttle program never lived up to its advertised potential. It was supposed to have one or two flights a month, and they got down to one or two a year. The space station, which was had to be a place for the shuttle to go, and a shuttle had to have and it needed a shuttle to get there. I think those were serious political mistakes. And in retrospect, today we're stalled out. We're vibrating between going to the moon or going to Mars or somewhere in between. It's sad to see that the space program really doesn't have the kind of leadership that it used to have.
Right. Well, you know what, Bill Anders, if I may, point taken. I always feel hopeful, though, when I look up at the stars, in part because of the work of people such as you, Jim Lovell, and Frank Borman. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Anders. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Megan. Nice to talk to you.
Well, Bill Anders, 50 years ago today, took the remarkable Earthrise photo from the Apollo 8 mission. We're going to close with the message that Commander Frank Borman gave to the people of Earth December 24th, 1968.
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.